issue is going to continue to plague us for months and years to come. And I think it's important for the American people that everybody in this town set politics aside, that everybody in this town sets our individual interests aside, and we try to do some tough stuff. And I've already taken some heat from my party for being willing to compromise. My expectation and hope is that everybody in the coming days is going to be willing to compromise. Last point I'll make, and then I'll take questions. We are obviously running out of time. And so what I've said to the members of Congress is that you need, over the next 24 to 36 hours, to give me some sense of what your plan is to get the debt ceiling raised through whatever mechanisms they can think about, and show me a plan in terms of what you're doing for deficit and debt reduction. If they show me a serious plan, I'm ready to move, even if it requires some tough decisions on my part. And I'm hopeful that over the next couple of days we'll see this logjam break, broken, because the American people, I think, understandably want to see Washington do its job. All right? So with that, let me see who's on the list. We're going to start with Jake Tapper.
Thank you, Mr. President. You've said that reducing the deficit will require shared sacrifice. We know we have an idea of the taxes that you would like to see raised on corporations and on Americans in the top two tax brackets, but we don't yet know what you specifically are willing to do when it comes to entitlement spending. In the interest of transparency, leadership, and offering, also showing the American people that you have been negotiating in good faith, can you tell us one structural reform that you are willing to make to one of these entitlement programs that would have a major impact on the deficit? Would you be willing to raise the retirement age? Would you be willing to means test Social Security or Medicare?
We've said that we are willing to look at all those approaches. I've laid out some criteria in terms of what would be acceptable. So, for example, I've said very clearly that we should make sure that current beneficiaries, as much as possible, are not affected. But we should look at what can we do in the out years so that over time some of these programs are more sustainable. I've said that means testing on Medicare, meaning people like myself, if I'm going to be turning 50 in a week, I'm starting to think a little bit more about Medicare eligibility. I'm going to get my AARP card soon and the discounts. You can envision a situation where for somebody in my position, me having to pay a little bit more on premiums or copays or things like that would be appropriate. And again, that could make a difference. So we've been very clear about where we're willing to go. What we're not willing to do is to restructure the program in the ways that we've seen coming out of the House over the last several months, where we would voucherize the program and you potentially have senior citizens paying $6,000 more. I view Social Security and Medicare as the most important social safety nets that we have. I think it is important for them to remain as social insurance programs that give people some certainty and reliability in their golden years. But it turns out that making some modest modifications in those entitlements can save you trillions of dollars. It's not necessary to completely revamp the program. What is necessary is to say, how do we make some modifications, including, by the way, on the provider side. I think that it's important for us to keep in mind that, drug companies, for example, are still doing very well through the Medicare program. Although we have made drugs more available at a cheaper price to seniors who are in Medicare through the Affordable Care Act, there's more work to potentially be done there. So if you look at a balanced package even within the entitlement programs, it turns out that you can save trillions of dollars while maintaining the core integrity of the program.
And the retirement age?
I'm not going to get into specifics. As I said, Jake, everything that you mentioned are things that we have discussed. But what I'm not going to do is to ask for even, well, let me put it this way. If you're a senior citizen and a modification potentially costs you $100 or $200 a year more, or even if it's not affecting current beneficiaries, somebody who's 40 today, 20 years from now, is going to end up having to pay a little bit more. The least I can do is to say that people who are making $1 million or more have to do something as well. And that's the kind of trade-off, that's the kind of balanced approach and shared sacrifice that I think most Americans agree needs to happen.
Thank you.
Hans.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. I just thought I heard you kind of open up the door to this middle-of-the-road possibility. I think you said, show me a serious proposal, a serious plan, and then I'm prepared to move. Just a few minutes before you came here, House Republicans said they'd be voting on this $2.4 trillion package that has a balanced budget amendment. Is that a serious plan? Is it dead on arrival, or does it short-circuit what you expect to happen in the next 24 or 36 hours?
I haven't looked at it yet, and I think my expectation is that you'll probably see the House vote on a couple of things just to make political statements. But if you're trying to get to $2.4 trillion without any revenue, then you are effectively gutting a whole bunch of discretion, domestic spending that is going to be too burdensome and is not going to be something that I would support. Just to be very specific, we've identified over $1 trillion in discretionary cuts, both in defense and domestic spending. That's hard to do. I mean, that requires essentially that you freeze spending. And when I say freeze, that means you're not getting inflation, so that these are programmatic cuts that over the course of 10 years, you'd be looking at potentially a 10% cut in domestic spending. Now, if you then double that number, you're then at that point really taking a big bite out of programs that are really important to ordinary folks. I mean, you're talking then about students accumulating thousands of dollars more in student loan debt every year. You're talking about federal workers and veterans and others potentially having to pay more in terms of their health care. So, I have not seen a credible plan, having gone through the numbers, that would allow you to get to $2.4 trillion without really hurting ordinary folks. And the notion that we would be doing that and not asking anything from the wealthiest among us or from closing corporate loopholes, that doesn't seem like a serious plan to me. I mean, the notion that, for example, oil company tax breaks, where the oil executives themselves say that they probably don't need them to have an incentive to go out and drill oil and make hundreds of billions of dollars. If we haven't seen the other side even budge on that, then I think most Democrats would say that's not a serious plan. One last point on the balanced budget amendment. I don't know what version they're going to be presenting, but some of the balanced budget amendments that have been floating up there, this cap or cut cap and balance, for example, when you look at the numbers, what you're looking at is cuts of $500 billion below the Ryan budget in any given year. I mean, it would require cutting Social Security or Medicare substantially. I think it's important for everybody to understand that all of us believe that we need to get to a point where eventually we can balance the budget. We don't need a constitutional amendment to do that. What we need to do is to do our jobs, and we have to do it the same way a family would do it. A family, if they get overextended and their credit card is too high, they don't just stop paying their bills. What they do is they say, how do we start cutting our monthly costs? We keep on making payments, but we start cutting out the things that aren't necessary. And we do it in a way that maintains our credit rating. We do it in a way that's responsible. We don't stop sending our kids to college. We don't stop fixing the boiler or the roof that's leaking. We do things in a sensible, responsible way. We can do the same thing when it comes to the federal budget.
So within that $2 trillion band, if you end up going for this middle-of-the-road package, which I think you referred to as the second option, would that need to have, for your signature, some sort of stimulative measures, either payroll tax extension or the extension of your unemployment insurance?
I think both would be good for the economy. A payroll tax cut is something that has put $1,000 in the pocket of the typical American family over the last 6-7 months, and has helped offset some of the rising costs in gasoline and food. And I think that American consumers and American businesses would benefit from a continuation of that that tax cut next year. Unemployment insurance. Obviously, unemployment is still too high. And you know, there are a lot of folks out there who are doing everything they can to find a job. But the market is still tight out there. And for us to make sure that they are able to stay in their homes potentially, or they're able to still support their families, I think is very important and contributes to the overall economy. So I think there are ways that you can essentially take a little over $1 trillion in serious discretionary cuts, meaningful discretionary cuts, and then start building on top of that some cuts in non-healthcare mandatory payments, you know, ethanol programs, or you know, how we calculate various subsidies to various industries. That could potentially be layered on, and we could still do something like a tax cut for ordinary families that would end up benefiting the economy as a whole. That is not my preferable option, though. I just want to be clear. I think about this like a layer cake. You know, you can do the bare minimum, and then you can make some progressively harder decisions to solve the problem more and more. And we're in a position now where if we're serious about this and everybody's willing to compromise, we can, as I said before, fix this thing probably for a decade or more. And that's something that I think would be good for overall business climate and would encourage the American people that Washington actually is willing to take care of its business.
It's good for the business, for the climate bill, but not required for your signature. Is that what I heard?
I'm sorry, I lost you on that one.
So you're saying these stimulative measures would be good for the business climate, good for the economy, but you're not saying that they need to be included for you to sign either $2 trillion or $4 trillion?
I've got to look at an overall package, Hans. I don't know what the Speaker or Mr. McConnell are willing to do at this point. Okay. Chuck Todd.
Mr. President, this process got kind of ugly in the last week, and it appears from the outside that I think even things even got a little futile with these meetings. Any regrets on your role and how this went? And do you have any regrets that you never took Bull Simpson, which was $4 trillion over 10 years, and spent the last 6 months selling that, which was a balanced package to the American people?
No. First of all, I think this notion that things got ugly is just not true. We've been meeting every single day, and we have had very constructive conversations. You know, the American people are not interested in the reality TV aspects of who said what and did somebody's feelings get hurt. They're interested in solving the budget problem and the deficit and the debt. And so that may be good for chatter in this town. It's not something that folks out in the country are obsessing about. I think with respect to Bull Simpson, it was important for us to Bull Simpson wouldn't have happened had I not set up the structure for it. As you will recall, this was originally bipartisan legislation that some of the Republican supporters of decided to vote against when I said I supported it. That seems to be a pattern that I'm still puzzled by. And so we set it up. They issued a report, and what I said was this provides us an important framework to begin discussions. But there were aspects of Bull Simpson that I said from very early on were not the approach I would take. I'll give you an example. On defense spending, a huge amount of their savings on the discretionary side came out of defense spending. I think we need to cut defense But as Commander-in-Chief, I've got to make sure that we're cutting it in a way that recognizes we're still in the middle of a war. We're winding down another war. And we've got a whole bunch of veterans that we've got to care for as they come home. And so what we've said is a lot of the components of Bull Simpson we are willing to embrace, for example, the domestic spending cuts that they recommend, we've basically taken. Others, like on defense, we have taken some but not all of the recommendations because it's important for it to be consistent with our defense needs and our security needs. The bottom line is that this is not an issue of salesmanship to the American people. The American people are sold. The American people are sold. I just want to repeat this.
The whole debate would have been different. You had Republican support on it. On Coburn, you had Republican senators signed on it.
Chuck, you have 80% of the American people who support a balanced approach. 80% of the American people support an approach that includes revenues and includes cuts. So the notion that somehow the American people aren't sold is not the problem. The problem is members of Congress are dug in ideologically into various positions because they boxed themselves in with previous statements. And, so this is not a matter of the American people knowing what the right thing to do is. This is a matter of Congress doing the right thing and reflecting the will of the American people. And if we do that, we will have solved this problem. Lori Montgomery.
Thank you, Mr. President. I wanted to ask you about the two trains that seem to be rolling down the tracks on the Hill. Specifically, Leader McConnell has laid out an elaborate plan to raise the debt limit. He said last night that it looks like they're going to pair that with a new committee that would be tasked with coming up with the big solution that you talk about by the end of the year. Your comment on that proposal. Meanwhile, in the House, they're saying, well, we could be flexible on some of our demands if we could get a balanced budget amendment. And they note that Vice President Biden voted for a BBA in 1997. Is there any way that that could be part of a solution? Is there any version of a BBA that you would support?
First of all, for the consumption of the general public, BBA meaning a balanced budget amendment. I think I already addressed this question earlier. We don't need a constitutional amendment to do our jobs. The Constitution already tells us to do our jobs and to make sure that the government is living within its means and making responsible choices. And so this notion that we're going to go through a multi-year process instead of seizing the moment now and taking care of our problems is a typical Washington response. We don't need more studies. We don't need a balanced budget amendment. We simply need to make these tough choices and be willing to take on our basis. And everybody knows it. I mean, we could have a discussion right here about what the numbers look like, and we know what's necessary. And here's the good news, that it turns out we don't have to do anything radical to solve this problem. Contrary to what some folks say, that we're not Greece, we're not Portugal. It turns out that our problem is we cut taxes without paying for them over the last decade. We ended up instituting new programs like a prescription drug program for seniors that was not paid for. We fought two wars. We didn't pay for them. We had a bad recession that required a Recovery Act and stimulus spending and helping states and all that accumulated, and there's interest on top of that. And to unwind that, what's required is that we roll back those tax cuts on the wealthiest individuals, that we clean up our tax code so we're not giving out a bunch of tax breaks to companies that don't need them and are not creating jobs. We cut programs that we don't need. And we invest in those things that are going to help us grow. And every commission that's been out there has said the same thing and basically taken the same approach within the margin of error. So my general view is that If the American people looked at this, they'd say, boy, some of these decisions are tough, but they don't require us to gut Medicare or Social Security. They don't require us to stop helping young people go to college. They don't require us to stop helping families who've got a disabled child. They don't require us to violate our obligations to our veterans. And they don't require, quote-unquote, job-killing tax cuts. They require us to make some modest adjustments to get our house in order. And we should do it now. With respect to Senator McConnell's plan, as I said, I think it is constructive to say that if Washington operates as usual and can't get anything done, let's at least avert Armageddon. I'm glad that people are serious about the consequences of default. But we have two problems here. One is raising the debt ceiling. This is a problem that was manufactured here in Washington because every single one of the leaders over there have voted for raising the debt ceiling in the past, and it has typically been a difficult but routine process. And we do have a genuine underlying problem that our debt and deficits are too big. So Senator McConnell's approach solves the first problem. It doesn't solve the second problem. I'd like to solve that second problem.
Are you looking at this option as a more likely outcome at this point, or can you share with us why you have some hope that the talks that have been going on might actually produce an outcome?
I always have hope. Don't you remember my campaign? Even after being here for 2.5 years, I continue to have hope. You know why I have hope? Is because of the American people. You know, when I talk to them and I meet with them, as frustrated as they are about this town, they still reflect good common sense. And all we have to do is align with that common sense on this problem, it can get solved. And I'm assuming that at some point, members of Congress are going to listen. I just want to repeat, every Republican, a number of Republican former elected officials, they're not in office now, would say a balanced approach that includes some revenue is the right thing to do. The majority of Republican voters say that approach is the right thing to do. The proposal that I was discussing with Speaker Boehner fell squarely in line with what most Republican voters think we should do. So the question is, at what point do folks over there start listening to the people who put them in office? Now's a good time. Sam Young.
Good morning, Mr. President. I'd like to go back to something Chuck asked, his first question, about the tone of this debate. I faintly remember your campaign, and I'm guessing that while it hasn't been ugly, as you say, it's not what you had in mind when you said you wanted to change the tone in Washington. When you have Senator McConnell making comments that he views these negotiations through the prism of 2012, how much does that poison the well? And going forward, if, big if, you can get a deal on this, can you get anything done with Congress for the next year and a half?
Well, let me say this. I'm not trying to poke at you guys. I generally don't watch what is said about me on cable. I generally don't read what's said about me, even in the Hill. And so, part of this job is having a thick skin and understanding that a lot of this stuff's not personal. That's not going to be an impediment to, whatever Senator McConnell says about me on the floor of the Senate is not going to be an impediment to us getting a deal done. The question's going to be whether at any given moment we're willing to set politics aside, at least briefly, in order to get something done. I don't expect politicians not to think about politics, but every so often there are issues that are urgent that have to be attended to and require us to do things we don't like to do, that run contrary to our base, that gets some constituency that helped elect us agitated, because they're looking at it from a narrow prism. We're supposed to be stepping back and looking at it from the perspective of what's good for the country. And if we are able to remind ourselves of that, then there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to get things done. Look, we've been obsessing over the last couple of weeks about raising the debt ceiling and reducing the debt and deficit. I tell you what the American people are obsessing about right now is that unemployment is still way too high, and too many folks' homes are still underwater, and prices of things that they need, not just that they want, are going up a lot faster than their paychecks are if they've got a job. And so even after we solve this problem, we still got a lot of work to do. Hans was mentioning we should renew the payroll tax for another year. We should make unemployment insurance is there for another year.
Sir,
we should. But you were making the point about whether or not that issue could be wrapped into this deal. My point is that those are a whole nother set of issues that we need to be talking about and working on. I've got an infrastructure bank bill that would start putting construction workers back to work, rebuilding our roads and bridges. We should be cooperating on that. Most of the things that I've proposed to help spur on additional job growth are traditionally bipartisan. I've got 3 trade deals sitting ready to go. And these are all trade deals that the Republicans told me were their top priorities. They said this would be one of the best job creators that we could have. And yet it's still being held up because some folks don't want to provide trade adjustment assistance to people who may be displaced as a consequence of trade. Surely we can come up with a compromise to solve those problems. So there will be huge differences between now and November 2012 between the parties. And whoever the Republican nominee is, we're going to have a big, serious debate about what we believe is the right way to guide America forward and to win the future. And I'm confident that I will win that debate, because I think that we've got the better approach. But in the meantime, surely we can every once in a while sit down and actually do something that helps American people right here and right now.
It's in the meantime, sir, that I'm curious about. As you just said, raising the debt ceiling is generally fairly routine, but it's brought us to the point of economic Armageddon, as we said. If you can get past this one, how can you get any agreement with Congress on those big issues you talked about?
I am going to keep on working, and I'm going to keep on trying. And what I'm going to do is to hope that, in part, this debate has focused the American people's attention a little bit more and will subject Congress to scrutiny. And I think increasingly the American people are going to say to themselves, you know what, if a party or a politician is constantly taking the position my way or the highway, constantly being locked into ideologically rigid positions, that we're going to remember at the polls. It's kind of cumulative. The American people aren't paying attention to the details of every aspect of this negotiation, but I think what the American people are paying attention to is who seems to be trying to get something done and who seems to be just posturing and trying to score political points. And I think it's going to be in the interests of everybody who wants to continue to serve in this town to make sure that they are on the right side of that impression. And that's, by the way, what I said in the meeting 2 days ago. I was very blunt. I said the American people do not want to see a bunch of posturing. They don't want to hear a bunch of sound bites. What they want is for us to solve problems. And we all have to remember that. That's why we were sent here. Last question, Scott Horsley.
President, I wonder if you've seen any sign in this week of daily meetings that Republicans are being more aligned with that American majority, or if we are in the same place today that we were on Monday.
It's probably better for you to ask them how they're thinking. I do think that, and I've said this before, Speaker Boehner, in good faith, was trying to see if it was possible to get a big deal done. He had some problems in his caucus. My hope is that after some reflection, after we walked through all the numbers this week and we looked at all the options, that there may be some movement, some possibility, some interest to still get something more than the bare minimum done. But we're running out of time. That's the main concern that I have at this point. We have enough time to do a big deal. You know, I've got reams of paper and printouts and spreadsheets on my desk, and so we know how we can create a package that solves the deficits and debt for a significant period of time. But in order to do that, we got to get started now, and that's why I'm expecting some answers from all the congressional leaders sometime in the next couple of days. And I have to say, you know, this is tough on the Democratic side, too. I mean, some of the things that I've talked about and said I would be willing to see happen, there are some Democrats who think that's absolutely unacceptable. And so that's where I'd have a selling job, Chuck, is trying to sell some of our party that if you are a progressive, you should be concerned about debt and deficit just as much as if you're a conservative. And the reason is because if the only thing we're talking about over the next year, 2 years, 5 years is debt and deficits, then it's very hard to start talking about how do we make investments in community colleges so that our kids are trained, how do we actually rebuild $2 trillion worth of crumbling infrastructure. You know, if you care about making investments in our kids and making investments in our infrastructure and making investments in basic research, then you should want our fiscal house in order so that every time we propose a new initiative, somebody doesn't just throw up their hands and say, ah, more big spending, more government. We, you know, it would be very helpful for us to be able to say to the American people, our fiscal house is in order. And so now the question is, what should we be doing to win the future and make ourselves more competitive and create more jobs, and what aspects of what government's doing are a waste and we should eliminate? And that's the kind of debate that I'd like to have. All right? Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Mr. President.
President Obama wrapping up a news conference in the Brady briefing room at the White House and talking with reporters about the debt ceiling talks, which are still stalemated. The president said that it is critical that he get answers from the congressional leaders within the next couple of days to get these talks started. He continued to hold out hope for the grand bargain, as it was called, a $4 trillion plus deal that he said could settle America's financial house, get our affairs in order for the next 10 to 15 years. He said it's also possible to talk about an approach that would cut more than $2 trillion and less acceptable, but still a down payment, as he put it. But there might be a backup plan. He said that's the least favorable outcome to just raise the debt ceiling without addressing America's problems. But if it comes to that, it's good that everybody seems to agree it needs to get done. This is special coverage from NPR News.
WILL surpassed its $2.1 million membership goal by more than $25,000. Thanks to your support, we're able to produce and purchase the programs you depend on. Thank you.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. You just heard President Obama talk about his side of the negotiations to try to get the debt ceiling raised in time. The deadline, again, is August 2nd. But as a practical matter, the president said he needs answers in the next couple of days. Just before the president emerged, an hour or so ago, the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, and his number two in the Republican caucus, Majority Leader Eric Cantor, held a news conference on Capitol Hill. They said it is still too early to go to Plan B. That's the McConnell plan to raise the debt ceiling without necessarily talking about the big deal on the budget and reducing the deficit. They announced Republicans plan to vote in the House of Representatives next week on a bill that would cut spending and link an increase to the debt limit to passage of a balanced budget amendment. And Speaker Boehner repeated, Republicans will not vote for new taxes as part of any deal.
Our stand on the debt limit has been clear. There can be no tax hikes because tax hikes destroy jobs. We need real spending cuts, and real spending cuts that will exceed the amount of increase in the debt limit. And we need real reforms to restrain the growth of spending in future years, like spending caps and like a real balanced budget amendment. Listen, we're in a fourth quarter here. Time and again, Republicans have offered serious proposals to cut spending and address these issues. And I think it's time for the Democrats to get serious as well. We asked the president to lead. We asked him to put forward a plan, not a speech, a real plan. And he hasn't. We will.
And the Majority Leader, Eric Cantor, then talked about the impression among some that it is the Democrats, and particularly President Obama, who's been willing to compromise and make cuts in treasured programs on the Democratic side, while Republicans have been rigid and unwilling to move. He said, no, the Republicans are just as willing to compromise.
Some of the reports have indicated that somehow Republicans haven't given. Now, I just tell you that's not true. We are at $6.2 trillion, they're at $1.5 trillion at best. And that's just the way it is. And so what we want and what we said as the Speaker continues to set out there, we want to change the system here. We want to be able to go home to the people that elected us and show them that we're not going to allow this kind of spending to continue. So we're going to bring a bill forward next week, otherwise known as the Cut, Cap, and Balance Bill, to provide a balanced approach so that we can demonstrate that we are getting things under control and that the people who put us here can gain some confidence that we're going to begin to live like they do around their kitchen tables and in their businesses, stop spending money we don't have, and begin to manage this debt and deficit down to balance.
With me here in the studio is NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. Ron, good morning.
Good morning, Neil.
And as we've listened to the statements from both sides, obviously capsules from what the Republicans had to say, but, well, those are interesting capsules. It seems that Scott Horsley's question at the end of the news conference was, have we moved anywhere since Monday? Doesn't sound like it.
Does not sound like it. A timely question, and the answer seems to be not really. There is some new material to discuss since Monday. We now have the McConnell Plan B fallback. Mitch McConnell, of course, is the Republican leader in the Senate. And he said, look, we don't seem to be getting anywhere here. These negotiations aren't bringing us anywhere closer to each other. And as long as President Obama is in office, we're probably not going to be able to dictate a Republican plan for addressing all of these issues. Therefore, why don't we just put something together whereby we raise the debt ceiling?
I'll make the president raise the debt ceiling.
That is to say, the debt ceiling gets raised. We don't do it. That is, the Republicans in Congress. And the president insists upon it for all the reasons that I think everyone is pretty much agreeing on, the negative effect on the markets, the negative effect on interest rates, the effect that that would have on the economy and on individuals. So McConnell says, let's just tell the president, we're going to give you the authority to raise the debt ceiling on your own. It's all up to you. It's your responsibility. Even though, of course, the debt ceiling is the creation of Congress all the way back to 1917, and the Congress has either raised it or extended it or done various and sundry things to it since 1939, 89 times, including 18 times, while Ronald Reagan was president, to deal with bumping up against the debt ceiling at that time. So this would be a unique, historically unprecedented approach for Congress to simply say, we're out of it. You decide, Mr. President. And a lot of conservatives in the Senate, a lot of Republicans are saying, whoa, the last thing in the world I want to do as a conservative Republican is give more power over the fiscal fate of America to Barack Obama.
And indeed, there are also some constitutional questions about whether this kind of an arrangement might be possible. But let's go to David Wellna up on Capitol Hill, NPR's congressional correspondent. And David Wellna, this is also a political question. Is the House of Representatives in any way ready to give the president that kind of power?
That's a good question, because it's clear that there are many House Republicans who are loath to hand that kind of power to President Obama and in effect, empower a minority in the House. One-third of the House would be able to sustain a presidential veto, and presumably it would be the Democrats who would be doing that, to give them the power to really dictate what's going to happen with the debt ceiling being raised. It's kind of a smoke and mirrors game that's going on here, of course. You have Republicans proposing to give Obama, President Obama, the power to raise the debt ceiling, and then they're counting on that he will propose something that they will then vote against, and that it would take a two-thirds majority of both chambers to override any veto of what they vote against. And so I think that the plan as it stands is one that would spare Republicans from ever having to vote for raising the debt ceiling. But the question is whether they can get to first base by giving President Obama the authority to propose raising the debt ceiling himself. It's not clear that you have enough House Republicans on board to do that.
And there is another issue. The president spoke of a financial Armageddon should this debt ceiling be allowed to lapse and the United States goes into default. He described this effectively. The interest rates would go up for everybody across the country, effectively a tax increase on all Americans. Tamara Keith, NPR business reporter, is also with us here in Studio 3A. And we've seen some of the rating agencies beginning to say, wait a minute, we're now thinking about downgrading the U.S. bond rating.
Exactly. The S&P on yesterday said that there's a 50% chance that it would downgrade the U.S. debt within 3 months. And one thing that they said that was interesting is that just solving the debt ceiling issue isn't enough for them, that they're also looking to a larger, that they mentioned a $4 trillion deficit reduction. That would be the big plan.
The grand design.
The grand one.
Grand bargain.
The grand bargain. And then Moody's, the day before, said that they've already put U.S. government debt on review for a possible downgrade. Yesterday, China was saying they're concerned. They want to make sure that investors are looked out for. China holds $1 trillion. That's $1 trillion of U.S. securities. And if the ratings were to be downgraded, and that's a big if. A lot of things have to happen before that would happen. But if they are downgraded, pension funds, lots of big buyers of treasuries, they need a AAA rating. These big buyers need a AAA rating to make purchases. And so that could cause huge problems.
But is this going to be a problem for investors in Beijing and investors on Wall Street? Is this just going to be felt by the elite people who seem to be making money at this point anyway?
Well, here's the thing. When the markets get spooked, everybody loses money. When the markets start falling, money market funds are invested. You know, your pensions, everything is invested. And so when the markets become spooked, value goes down, people lose money. Also, interest rates go up when treasuries, when people flee from treasuries, interest rates go up on things like mortgages and credit cards, very real pocketbook issues.
Which gets us back to focusing political attention on a crisis that needs to be resolved in time. And well, we can go through some of the timing scenarios a little bit later. But Ron Elving, the president repeatedly said 80% of Americans believe in a balanced approach, one that involves increasing tax revenues, and that seems to be the big sticking point for Republicans in Congress, tax revenues, increasing tax revenues. 80% of Americans, indeed a majority of Republican voters, believe now in a balanced approach. He says, I'm just waiting for those people over there to start listening to the folks who put them into office.
Well, the people who put them into office are not literally the same people who are being polled here, because the people who put people into office in our country are frequently people who make campaign contributions, who are campaign activists, who are the most excited about any given election. And so the people that...
And vote in primaries.
And who vote in primaries, exactly. So the people who are representing the Republican Party in Congress today, who are representing states and districts around the country that vote Republican, those folks are concerned about a number of things. And of course, they're concerned about the country. But they're also concerned about the prospect that they, like some of their colleagues, would be, as the usage of the word goes, primaried. They would get a primary opponent who came to them from their fiscal right side, somebody perhaps from the Tea Party, who would come in and say, you're not conservative enough because you compromised with the president, and defeat them in their next primary, which is coming up pretty quickly for House members. It would be just next spring. And for about a third of the Senate, it's just next spring that they have to get renominated to keep their seat. And, you know, last time in 2010, we saw some of the most conservative, longstanding pillars of the Senate, really, people like Robert Bennett in Utah, defeated in a primary. And this time around in 2012, we already know that Orrin Hatch from Utah has got a primary. We know Richard Lugar from Indiana. Again, pillars of the Senate, some of the longest serving Republican conservatives, are actually being primaried and may lose. So that fear is abroad in the Congress in a big way, and they don't necessarily look at the whole picture of the entire electorate the way polls do. They look at the people they're most concerned about having vote for them in Republican primaries and also contribute to their campaigns.
And just before the emails come in, we know Utah has a special conference system. It's not quite a primary. It's
right.
A little bit different.
I'm using the word generically.
Broadly. But in any case, David Wellen, let me turn back to you on Capitol Hill. There is clear frustration that you could hear in Eric Cantor's voice in that cut of tape that we played earlier, where he said, we want to change the system here. We want to be able to go home to the people that elected us and show them we're not going to allow this kind of spending to continue. And indeed, it seems to be this is our opportunity, he seems to be saying, to restructure things fundamentally, to get a smaller government that uses less money, that taxes less.
That's true. It may be an opportunity, but what Republicans are proposing, they know already, is not going to pass, perhaps not even in the House, but certainly not in the Senate, this constitutional amendment that would... they claim balance the budget, although it does not actually require that the budget be balanced. In fact, the budget that the House Republicans approved earlier this year, the Paul Ryan's budget, would not even qualify under the rules of this constitutional amendment that they're proposing. This, I think, is mostly giving those people who are firmly committed to shrinking the size of the government and feel that this is the moment to do it, a way to say, I voted to do that, even though we may have ended up allowing the debt ceiling to go up. We did the right thing. The Democrats didn't accompany us. Elect more Republicans next year, and maybe we can get this. I think that's really what's going on here. President Obama characterized this vote really as kind of posturing on the part of Republicans. I think, though, that in some ways it could ease getting to some kind of a final deal, because there would be the political cover that Republicans could claim from having voted for this.
So that's one thing. There is also some sentiment in just not the House of Representatives, but amongst some of the presidential campaigners in the Republican Party, Tamara Keith, that if the deadline passes and there is no agreement, there's no deal, not even the McConnell backup deal, the sun would still come up the next day, that this is a bluff, essentially, by the president and the Democrats to try to get their plan through to roll the Republicans, and that indeed, they say about investors, well, where else are they going to go?
Well, and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke has made it pretty clear. He was before Congress yesterday saying, no, this is real. Let's take this seriously. It's interesting to watch the people who don't believe it's real and the people that do believe it's real. But the Treasury Department does believe it's real. And they've been going out to investors, at least on some level, and saying, hey, could we sell the gold? Or, you know, is there Fort Knox. Right. Is there some sort of backup here that could blunt this? And the answer they seem to be getting is, no, not really. It's a big deal if the U.S. government goes into default on its responsibilities. And what the ratings agencies are saying is that it sends this signal that if you can't deal with this thing that is basically very simple and should just be a formality, then what can you deal with? Can you take on these bigger austerity measures that are likely to be needed down the line?
And Ron, in a sense, both parties seem to be saying, well, maybe we can't deal with these things. Maybe we need some sort of stopgap thing, and let us focus on these issues come 2012. This is what the presidential campaign is going to be about, that and jobs. And this is going to be decided by the American people, not just in terms of who they elect to be the next president of the United States, but, well, the Republicans feel pretty confident they can take over the United States Senate. Some Democrats feel pretty confident they might be able to take back the House.
That's right. It's a wide-open election. The president may be in a good position right now for re-election. In some measures, a big fundraising success announced this week, much more money than the Republican candidates running ahead of them in the polls. But if unemployment remains as high as it is now, I think all bets are off, and the re-election of the president is far, far from assured. As you say, the House could be in play. That may be a little farther reach, but the House could be in play. The Senate surely is in play. Either party could be in control of the Senate next time. And I think there is a mentality among many of the members. It has a kind of sports aspect to it that, well, let's get out and decide it on the field, or let's take this fight outside. The problem is that the debt ceiling comes up completely independent of the election cycle, and it has many, many, many times since 1917, and that has to be dealt with. And making that into an element of political football, if you will, that is irresponsible, and I think everyone in the leadership of both parties has said, we can't do that. The problem is that they have now brought themselves to the cliff. They have not a lot of good fallback positions, and so they're at the cliff about to fall over.
And that's the final question to you, David Wellner. Why are we exactly at the cliff? It is the 15th of July. That, by my calculation, gives us a couple of weeks at least before we get to August the 2nd. Why does the president need answers? And whatever's going to happen by the weekend.
Well, it takes a while to get things done in Congress. Whatever proposal comes out, if one does prevail in these talks, it's going to have to be turned into legislative language. It's going to have to be run by the various caucuses. It's going to have to go through both the House and the Senate. And in the Senate in particular, it can be very complicated getting things through because each member of the Senate has many tools at his or her disposal to hold things up. And we already have Senator Jim DeMint, a Republican from South Carolina, vowing that he will use every tool to stop the Plan B that Senator McConnell is proposing. And I imagine that he would do the same with some of the other proposals out there.
And he has some friends as well who will help him in that regard. What, 8, 10, so many members of the Republican caucus who may be eager to see if they can filibuster this. Even there are post-cloture, after you shut down debate in a cloture vote, you can still debate filibuster and drag this out. So it is a very complicated process. The House of Representatives, much more straightforward. It is an example of some straight up or down vote, and it can get done. In any case, David Wellner, thank you very much. Ron Elving here with us in the studio, and Tamara Keith, you've been listening to special coverage from NPR News.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
And now let's take a quick look at how the markets are doing. Hard red winter wheat for September at 7.77 1/4, currently up 12. December at 8.01 3/4, up 10 3/4. And March at 8.16 3/4, up 9 3/4. September wheat 7.12, up 5. December 7.39 1/2, up 1 1/4. And March 2012 wheat at 7.67 3/4, up 2 3/4. September corn 7.10 1/4, up 19 1/2. December at 6.92 1/4, up 13 3/4. March 2012, 703, up 12 3/4. July 2012, corn, 7, 12 3/4, up 12 1/4. The August crude oil, 97.29, up $1.60. And right now, the soybeans for August are at 13.92, up 9 3/4. September at 13.